We're talking this hour about the promise of America and a few people who've helped carve out a new vision for the country. One of those was Mark Twain. His new biographer, Ron Powers, is out to abolish the stereotype of Mark Twain as the kindly old uncle who told stories about wayward boys. He says Samuel Clemens was a visionary, one who found a new American voice. Powers says Sam developed and honed that distinctive voice out west in Nevada.
What he did out there was walk into a kind of countercultural enclave that centered around a little newspaper called the Territorial Enterprise in Virginia City. And it was staffed by these kind of misfit, visionary, poet, wandering fugitives, a lot like hippies. Now, the way in which they invented the new American voice, and they didn't do it on purpose, was that they simply wrote out of their spontaneity, out of their passions, out of their drunkenness, out of their wish to play tricks and play tall tales on one another. What I'm saying is that no one was looking over their shoulder. Ralph Waldo Emerson wasn't in town, and neither was Longfellow, and neither was Thoreau. So nobody was telling these guys to be polite. And what they did was they improvised a kind of blunt, direct, slang-driven kind of argot that caught something very powerful.
Of course, you keep saying they, and there were a number of men out there who were all exposed to the same argot. But
right.
It was something about Sam Clemens that picked that up, that he had the ear for it, that he could hear that language and move it on into society that wasn't used to it yet.
He had an incredible ear. He had an ear for language. He had an eye for detail that started becoming apparent when he was about 4 years old, back on his uncle's farm in Missouri, when he was a little tiny red-haired kid who'd just gotten out of a sickbed, wandered by himself down to the slave quarters, and he hung out with these people who were talking to one another and singing to one another in this richly encoded language that was part African, part American spiritual, part gospel. They were telling one another stories and giving important news that the adult white people were only dimly, if at all, aware of. Sammy got it. He stored that language up, and when he was ready to write the character Jim in Huckleberry Finn, it was there for him. And then he had the comic voice, that sort of shrewd voice that could invert reality just a little bit and surprise your expectations. But the voice he replaced was ready to be replaced. I mean, Emerson was a wonderful, he's a permanent treasure to our culture, and Longfellow and Holmes and Hawthorne. But these guys were trying to write like Europeans. They were trying to carry on the high British Anglican tradition of rhetoric. Sam Clemens's great gift was that he was out there where people didn't care about the high Anglican tradition. They cared about having a yuck and a beer and reading a good gossip item to go with it. And that's where he honed his talent.
You know, it's funny, the image I think I have of Mark Twain, of Sam Clemens, is always the older Sam
right.
Clemens, the one with the white hair and the big mustache. I mean, the Hal Holbrook version that we've seen.
Yeah.
And it surprised me so much when you talk, in the very beginning of your book, you talk about this red-haired, wiry, nervous, energetic young man that doesn't sound like the Twain we've seen pictures of at all.
I am so glad you mentioned that. And what I found myself fascinated by was everything about him that did not fit the stereotype of this kindly old white-haired, pipe-smoking uncle sitting on the porch and telling stories about boys playing hooky. That was not him at all. He was a man of incredible passion. His comedy was uproarious. His pain was unbearable even to read about. His anger was truly frightening. And his love, his capacity for tenderness toward his wife, Livy, and the Shakespearean beauty of the letters that he wrote to her when they were courting are unexampled, I think, certainly in American literature. So, yes, he was a lot of things before he was a white-haired old man.
This is another of those misconceptions about him, though, isn't it? Because we think of him as having essentially never left Hannibal, Missouri. I mean, everybody.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, you think about Huck Finn, Tom Sawyer, growing
right.
up on the Missouri, being on the Mississippi. That's Mark Twain. But, of course, he was much more than that. He must have seen all of America at some point.
Well, he did. He was, when he left Hannibal, he fetched up in St. Louis down the river about 100 miles, set type in that city, and then He made this unbelievable cross-country journey to the East Coast. He negotiated stagecoach fares, railroad itineraries, a steamship voyage across Lake Erie. He ends up in New York City, where he finds himself very much at ease on Broadway. He's looking at plays. He's going to the Crystal Palace for the exhibition. Before long, he's in Philadelphia. And not long after that, he is a 17-year-old kid. He is in Washington, D.C., in the visitors' gallery of the United States Senate, looking down and watching the Missouri Compromise being debated. And that was only the start.
But then there was this next move, which was out to Virginia City and later to San Francisco, when it seems to me that the infusion of that Western language really began to create the character that we know.
Yes. I mentioned hippies a few minutes ago. In fact, the beginning of the American counterculture was following him west, or had just gotten there ahead of him to San Francisco. These were the people like Walt Whitman who hung out at Pfaff's Beer Hall on Broadway. They called themselves Bohemians, and they needed a city large enough that they could get lost in it and they wouldn't be conspicuous. And it took a while for a city to develop that big. And Sam was in on the big bang of what would later become the San Francisco counterculture.
But how did he make the transition then? It's one thing for him to go out west and learn this voice and make himself well-read there, but how did he then go back east? And even though the tradition of Emerson, Thoreau, Holmes may have been ready to be replaced, how is it that Twain was the one?
I was once at a press party toward the end of Jimmy Cagney's life. Hundreds of reporters gathered around him asking him questions. He was very reclusive. And an earnest young woman said, "Mr. Cagney, how did you ever work up the motivation for that wonderful scene in which you push the grapefruit into May Bush's face?" And Cagney answered, "Didn't. Just did it." And that's what Sam did. He just did it. He improvised. He went back not knowing what tomorrow would bring. And he signed on to the first pleasure cruise in the history of America, the voyage to the Holy Land aboard the steamship Quaker City. He wanted to report it. He found himself among all these pious, middle-aged Puritans, and he grew so sick of their pretense and their reverence for the old relics, even while they were putting the relics in their side pockets, that he came back and wrote, just vent his spleen over them, didn't really care who was going to read it, and that became The Innocents Abroad, which is still a wonderfully readable book, and that abolished pious travel writing for all time, and it led him to believe that he really did have something to say in his voice.
The other thing that struck me in reading your account of Twain's life is that his popularity as a writer was fueled by his extraordinary appeal as a speaker. He went out and sold himself.
I guess if my book is going to get roasted, it may get roasted over the claim that I make that he was our first rock and roll star. But when he walked out on stage in McGuire's Academy in San Francisco in, I think, 1867, he was just back from a tour of the Sandwich Islands. He was broke. He had no prospects. He knew that if he lectured a little bit, he could make some money. So he hired a hall, hung the town with billboards advertising this talk he was going to give. Walked into the auditorium, sat behind the curtain for an hour before it started, so frightened that he said he could see the face of death. Walked out on stage, looked at this sea of faces, and was traumatized into silence, shuffled toward the podium, and people found right then and there, they found something going on with that man that they had never seen before. He looked at them. He made eye contact with every person in that hall, it seemed. And when he began to speak in that slow, thoughtful, hesitant drawl of his, he was funny. He was captivating regardless of what he had to say. As I say, in that moment, America found itself beholding its first rock star.
Twain really is going to be remembered as a great literary representative of the American dream. But it's wrong to talk about him in the past, isn't it? I mean, in some ways, Twain is very modern.
I believe you're right. I mean, obviously he was a 19th century man. There's no getting around it. But he, of all the people I've read about and whose works I have read from the 19th century, this man is far and away the most contemporary. He is the most recognizable. His idioms, his sense of the practical joke, his sense of parody, parodying magazine styles, and working an audience from the stage, and his love of gadgetry, his the telephone that he installed, he rode in a car, he recorded his voice on wax cylinder, some of Edison's wax cylinders, and they're out there buried in some basement somewhere, and I really hope somebody finds them before I go, because I'd like to hear him. But yes, he was a very contemporary man.
That's Ron Powers, who joined us from Middlebury College in Vermont. His biography is called Mark Twain, A Life.